The Swiss Confederation. The Swiss Confederation went further than any of these examples by separating from the empire as an independent state. Like the peasant communities of the Northwest, those of the empire's long alpine strip were also favored by geography, though of a very different kind. The mountains allowed varied forms of agriculture and animal husbandry, sustaining a modest population that did not need to move since others traveled through their lands, which lay across the routes between Burgundy, Germany, and Italy. Control of vital passes made the Alpine communities strategically important to all medieval monarchs, and helps explain the rich ecclesiastical endowments in this region, which included the Archbishopric of Salzburg, the bishoprics of Basel, Chur, Brixen, and Trent, and important abbeys like St. Gallen and Einsiedeln. The mountain ridges made lateral communications often very difficult and encouraged a wide variety of communities, including numerous small and medium-sized towns and different kinds of villages, as well as lay and spiritual lordships. Apart from the local bishops, the senior lords tended to be busy elsewhere, creating scope for local self-rule, similar to that encountered in the North Sea marshes. Like the Frisians, local communities developed a myth of ancient freedoms that were in fact quite new, dating mainly to the 12th century. Jurisdiction followed natural features like valleys, helping to shape how communities engaged with each other. Central and western Switzerland saw the development of incorporated valleys, Talschaften, which in turn formed the basis of what were later called cantons. By contrast, communal forms developed within lordly lesser jurisdictions in Riesche, Vorarlberg, and the Tyrol in the Eastern Alps, where judges' circuits formed the basis for districts. Both the cantons and districts established management committees to coordinate common activities and represent the inhabitants in dealings with outsiders. There is a tendency to lose sight of this diversity in favor of the stirring story of hardy Swiss mountaineers, such as William Tell, overthrowing Habsburg lordship and establishing what is widely interpreted as one of the modern world's first democracies. In fact, the William Tell story only surfaced around 1470, long after Swiss communities acquired self-governance. The process of emancipation involved some communities asserting their own control over others, broadly similar to the dominance of Italian cities over their hinterlands. Meanwhile, the complexity of settlement patterns led to differing forms of engagement with local and more distant lords, including the emperor, any one of whom might be an ally rather than an enemy under some circumstances. Moreover, the formation of communal governance in the Alps needs to be placed in the wider context of the empire's reorganization along feudal and territorial lines, which, by the 13th century, increasingly compelled previously peripheral areas to define their own status and relationship to more distant communities. In particular, the fragmentation of the old Duchy of Swabia ended the political unit previously containing much of the Alps, including the former Roman province of Riesche. The extinction of the Zähringen dukes in 1218 led to the emancipation of Bern and Zurich as imperial cities, especially as the Staufers saw the granting of political immediacy as a way to prevent key Alpine routes falling into the hands of potential rivals amongst the empire's princely elite. To this end, Henry, (the 7th, bought up the Habsburgs' claims from the Zähringen inheritance to exercise jurisdiction over the Uri and Schwyz valleys in 1231 and 1240, since these gave access to the newly pioneered St. Gotthard Pass, opened in 1230. Like Bern and Zurich, the valleys became part of the royal lands under direct Staufer protection, but with communal self-government. Much of the conflict that emerged by the late 13th century was not against feudalism, but involved disputes over the exercise of stewardship rights, Vogtteirechte, associated with management of the crown lands in the wake of the Stauffer's demise. These disputes often pitted local nobles against more powerful outsiders like the Habsburgs, who wanted to control the powerful abbeys of Einsiedeln and Engelberg. The abbeys and towns pursued their own interests in these conflicts, such as Zurich and Bern, which asserted control over their own hinterlands. Meanwhile, the economic transformation of the Alpine valleys across 1200 to 1400 involved smallholders being dispossessed by cattle ranchers, expanding their operations to feed populations in the growing Lombard cities. Rudolf I's election as king in 1273 transformed the situation by adding royal power to the Habsburgs' already considerable regional influence, thanks to his family's existing possession of the county jurisdiction around Zurich. Rudolf's policy of revindication appeared particularly threatening to many Swiss lords and communities, who perceived it as a bid to consolidate Habsburg power along the Upper Rhine and Western Alps. The famous Oath Comradeship, Eidgenossenschaft, between the three incorporated valleys of Uri, Schwyz, and Unterwalden was made in August 1291, 2 weeks after Rudolf's death, because they feared the election of another Habsburg as king. Such associations were not uncommon, and that of 1291 was not celebrated as the foundation of Swiss independence until 1891. It was directed against a perceived lordly threat, and was not a bid to leave the empire. Indeed, Alpine communities generally looked to the emperor to consolidate their autonomy by enshrining it in legal charters. Henry VII granted a privilege in 1309, endorsing the three valleys as self-governing rural feudatories, forming their own imperial bailiwick directly under him. Imperial politics again intervened to push this development, since the double election of 1314 raised the possibility of another Habsburg, Frederick the Fair, as king. Frederick's relation, Duke Leopold of Austria, intervened to punish the Schwyz peasants who had plundered Einsiedeln Abbey, which was under his protection. His punitive expedition was defeated at Morgarten on the 15th of November 1315, though only around 100 of his troops were killed, and not the thousands claimed by some later historians. Nonetheless, it was a significant reverse, precipitating the collapse of Habsburg influence in the area based on possession of the rights of imperial bailiff. The three valleys renewed their confederation, which was increasingly known to outsiders as the Schwyzer or Swiss. Their status of imperial immediacy elevated the confederates above other rural communities and made them acceptable partners for cities like Bern and Zurich, enabling the confederation to expand between 1332 and 1353 through additional alliances with other cantons. Habsburg regional influence, however, grew simultaneously with the acquisition of the Breisgau, 1368, immediately to the north, and the Tyrol, 1363, to the east, while their competition with the Luxembourgs encouraged redoubled efforts to reassert authority over the Swiss. Habsburg defeats at Zemplach, 1386, and Neufels, 1388, coincided with the First Civic War and the general backdrop of protest following the Black Death. The Alpine communities further east responded to Habsburg encroachment from the Tyrol by forming the God's House League, Schade, 1367, Riesche, or the Grey League, Grison, 1395, and the Ten Parish League, 1436. They combined in 1471 as a federation known as the Three Leagues, Drei Bunde, which encompassed 52 communities with a total population of 76,000 by the 18th century. A further League above the lake emerged among communities south of Lake Constance during a revolt by the Appenzell region against the Abbot of St. Gallen in 1405. Although joined by communities in the Vorarlberg, Upper, Southern, Swabia, and the imperial city of St. Gallen, This league was crushed by the local knights, combining as the League of St. George's Shield in 1408. Despite the sharper social tension, localism and conflicting interests prevented a broad alliance between the different Alpine leagues. The Swiss allied with Appenzell in 1411, but only admitted it as a member of their confederation in 1513. Each of the three leagues allied separately with the confederation in 1497 to 1499, but reaffirmed their own federation in 1524. Meanwhile, the Swiss pursued their own policy of expansion, conquering the rural communities of the Aargau, 1415, and Thurgau, 1460, from the Habsburgs. The growing military reputation of the Swiss allowed their leaders to sign lucrative contracts with the French king and Italian princes to supply mercenaries, entangling the Confederation in more distant politics, notably the wars against Ducal Burgundy from the 1440s to 1477, and the Italian Wars after 1494. The Swiss also responded to Burgundian and Savoyard pressure from the west and south by accepting the imperial cities of Fribourg, 1478, and Solothurn, 1481, as members. The Valtellina and other parts of Milan were conquered by the Swiss in 1512. These conflicts were frequently brutal. Swiss and German troops waged bad war, meaning the normal rules governing the taking of prisoners were suspended. However, the wider context remained strategic rather than ideological. France's intrusion into Italy after 1494 heightened the significance of the Alpine passes to the empire's integrity. Crucially, this coincided with the peak of imperial reform, forcing the Alpine communities to define their relationship to the empire. Their earlier conflicts with the Habsburgs had left them suspicious of the new Reichstag, and they refused the summons to attend meetings after 1471, in contrast with the German cities, who used this opportunity to integrate themselves in the empire as full imperial estates. The Swiss held their own assemblies, Tagsetzungen, after 1471. These drew in Basel, Zurich, and other local towns like Luzern, which might otherwise have participated in the Reichstag, while the three leagues held separate meetings, especially after renewing their federation in 1524. The introduction of the common penny tax in 1495 forced a decision. For the first time, the empire was asking the Alpine communities for a substantial financial contribution, yet appeared to offer little in return, having largely left the Swiss on their own to repel the Burgundians before 1477. Moreover, the Swiss did not feel the need for the new imperial public peace, because they had already agreed a version of this through their own confederation. The Swiss refusal compelled Maximilian I to respond with force to assert both his imperial and Habsburg regional authority. The resulting conflict was known, depending on perspective, as the Swiss or Swabian War. Maximilian mobilized the Swabian League on the basis of his membership as ruler of Austria and the Tyrol in January 1499. The Swiss won three victories, but failed to cross the Rhine northwards into Swabia, and so accepted the compromise peace of Basel on the 22nd of September. It would be premature to call the treaty the birth of Swiss independence. The Swiss were granted exemption from the taxes and institutions agreed at the 1495 Reichstag, but otherwise remained within imperial jurisdiction. Both the Confederation and the Three Leagues continued to display their roots in the empire's socio-political order. They remained networks of separate alliances between distinct communities that retained their own identity, laws, and self-government. In this respect, the Confederation failed to match the Dithmarschen peasants, who already had a codified constitution and common legal system by the mid-15th century. Neither the Confederation nor the Three Leagues had a capital. A few communities remained apart, notably Gersau, which effectively acquired imperial immediacy when its local lord sold his rights to the parishioners in 1390. As with the other places, Gersau's inhabitants secured imperial confirmation of their immediacy in 1418 and 1433. Although they had cooperated with the Swiss since 1332, the fact that their tiny community was only accessible by boat across Lake Luzerne enabled them to remain fully autonomous until 1798, when they were forced by France to join the Swiss Confederation and the Three Leagues in the new Helvetic Republic. The Confederation eventually encompassed 13 cantons with 940,000 inhabitants by 1600. Basel, Bern, Luzerne, and Zurich were civic republics that had extended economic and political dominance over their rural hinterlands, similar to the pattern in northern Italy. Tensions from this process erupted periodically into civil war, notably between 1440 and 1446, when Zurich was temporarily expelled from the Confederation. Confessional differences following the Reformation exacerbated existing rivalries. Renewed conflict prompted a compromise in 1531 that prefigured the Empire's Peace of Augsburg, 1555, by fixing the confessional identity of each canton. The six Protestant cantons were especially concerned not to push their seven Catholic neighbors into a closer alliance with the Habsburgs. The Swiss rejected the formalized status hierarchy entrenched in the empire by imperial reform, and instead did not differentiate between the more urbanized and the rural cantons, each of which had two votes in the Federal Assembly. However, canton boundaries reflected their origins as imperial fiefs, meaning they varied considerably in size and wealth. Protestant wealth and population grew faster, adding to the resentment that the Catholics had two more votes. The Peace of Aargau stabilized the Confederation after renewed civil war in 1712, but without resolving the underlying problems. Meanwhile, both the Confederation and the Three Leagues controlled subordinate dependencies conquered collectively during their period of territorial expansion between 1415 and 1512. These areas retained self-government, but were denied representation in the federal assemblies. The Italian-speaking Catholic inhabitants of the Valtellina especially resented domination by the Protestant German speakers of Riccia, leading to prolonged unrest between 1620 and 1639. In short, the exclusion of superior lords did not bring peace, but was followed by serious socio-economic and religious divisions. Social practice remained hierarchical, and only outsiders believed the Swiss were all peasants. Swiss equality involved the assertion that they were equal to any noble, opening the door to a noble lifestyle for those who could afford it. Lordly jurisdictions were converted into property rights that generally passed to a class of powerful rich families like the Salis, Planter, Guler, and Schauensteins in Riccia, for instance. These displayed their status through coats of arms and used their near monopoly on communal posts, like district judges or military commanders, to secure access to the best meadows and take control of lucrative transit trade. Rhetian politics became particularly nasty during the later 16th century, when unscrupulous leaders exploited mass assemblies of enfranchised citizens to promote their own agendas, which could culminate in armed intimidation, kangaroo courts, or, in the worst case, the sectarian massacre of 1620. Populist politics exposed communalism's dark side and was, unfortunately, the one area where the Alpine communities deviated substantially in political culture from the empire. The German Peasants' War. Otherwise, Alpine communal self-government was similar to that found in many rural areas across the empire. The crown lands not only included towns and abbeys, but at least 120 autonomous villages immediately under the emperor's jurisdiction. These imperial villages, Reichsdörfer, were sold off fairly quickly once the dissipation of crown lands began in the late 14th century, because they were considered less valuable assets than the towns. The free people of the Leutkirch Heath near Ravensburg were repeatedly pawned, but survived thanks to their having been attached to the imperial bailiwick of Swabia since the 1270s, and in 1541 were eventually redeemed by the Habsburgs, who saw the jurisdiction as useful in managing their scattered southwest German possessions. Leutkirch retained its autonomy until 1802, when the Habsburgs were obliged to cede it to Bavaria. Another four villages survived through similar quirks. The bulk of the German rural population still enjoyed communal self-government, having bargained improved rights following the Black Death. Alliances between communes already served as a platform for large-scale revolts in the Rhineland and Swabia during the late 15th and early 16th centuries. Foremost among these was the Bundschuh movement, so called after its symbol of an unlaced boot. The Poor Conrad Rising of 1514 proved fundamental in consolidating the Württemberg estates as a check on ducal authority. The revolts were a response to the intensification of lordship, as lords used the economic and demographic recovery after 1470 to try to regain the influence they had lost a century earlier. Peasants objected to new restrictions on their access to woods and streams, as well as tax demands that grew with the common penny and other imperial taxes. Existing lordly structures were poorly placed to handle large-scale protest, which soon overwhelmed the system of lesser jurisdiction with its village and district courts. The highly fragmented jurisdiction in southwest Germany left peasants without clear opportunities to appeal against unfavorable verdicts. A new rising began in May 1524 as a protest against taxation, but became radicalized within 6 months after the rapid diffusion of Reformation evangelism and the media revolution. 25,000 copies of the Upper Swabian Peasants' 12 Articles were printed within 2 months of their appearance in Memmingen. The articles were the most famous of several sets of demands. Only 13% of the programs included the demand that communities should elect their own pastors, meaning the freedom to adopt the Reformation, whereas 90% attacked serfdom and lordly exactions. References to religion were part of a broader call for a fairer society. The third of the 12 articles claimed, "It is demonstrated by Scripture that we are free and wish to be free," but qualified this by saying, "Not that we wish to be completely free and to have no authority, for God does not teach us that." What the peasants really wanted is not always clear, because their programs were usually drawn up with the assistance of burgher lawyers. Many clearly thought their villages were, or should be, directly subordinate to the emperor. All expressed loyalty to the emperor, who was a conveniently distant authority. Their main concern was securing real improvements in their daily lives. The murder of lords and princes was very rare, and most hoped the authorities would become their Christian brothers in an idealized harmony. Rebels in larger territories like Bamberg and the Tyrol envisaged forming assemblies exclusively composed of commoners, Landschaften, to govern alongside their prince, while those in Württemberg, Baden and Salzburg planned to use similar institutions as the sole form of territorial government. Rebels, in more fragmented areas, attempted something closer to the organization of the Swiss and Dithmarschen peasants by forming sworn associations of autonomous communities. Few of these plans were realized, owing to the violence and to rapidly changing events. The rising developed its own momentum as the German Peasants' War, with around 300,000 under arms by 1525, in a clear demonstration of the potency of communal government. Peasant organization was often quite sophisticated, with villages sending men on rotation to spread the burden and minimize social and economic disruption. However, peer pressure was also often necessary, with participation enforced by the threat of expulsion from the community. The initial spread was facilitated by the inability of the authorities to coordinate a response. Individual lords often conceded local demands, emboldening neighboring communities to voice demands as well. Mühlhausen, in Thuringia, was one of the few imperial cities openly to join the peasants. Solidarity elsewhere was fragile at best, and peasants often resented burghers almost as much as lords. The city's decision to back the princes in the Swabian League proved a major factor in the peasants' eventual defeat. Working through the League, the authorities made further tactical concessions to isolate radicals from moderates while they gathered their forces to restore order in the name of the empire's public peace. Around 75,000 to 100,000 ordinary folk were killed, amounting to 10 to 15% of able-bodied males in the worst affected regions. The outcome has widely been interpreted as a failure, condemning Germany to an authoritarian future. In fact, it stabilized the empire's corporate social order. Many communities secured real improvements. Even the Swabian League's commander, Georg Truxes von Waldburg, granted most of his own peasants' demands. Peasant representation was incorporated into the estates in the Tyrol, Salzburg, Baden, and several smaller territories. Social regulation was tightened, partly to address perceived injustice, but also to win the loyalty of householders, whose position, relative to other community members, was strengthened through new legislation. Finally, the system of imperial justice was substantially revised in 1526 to extend the right of appeal and channel future grievances towards peaceful arbitration. Turning Swiss. It took some time for these changes to ease tensions, especially as economic conditions worsened for many people during the last third of the 16th century. Meanwhile, the Swiss Confederation appeared to offer an alternative, encouraging a desire among peasants and burghers to turn Swiss. Although the Hegau and Sundgau communities applied to join during the Peasants' War, most were too far away for this to be an immediate option, while the Confederation had no desire to become involved. Southwest German peasants continued to voice this aspiration occasionally during disputes with lords into the 18th century. Imperial cities had greater prospects, since they enjoyed the same immediacy as the Swiss cantons. The Confederation extended special protection to favored allies as associated places, Zugewandte Orte, after 1475. The issue became pressing during the 1530s as Zwinglianism, the Swiss brand of Protestantism, gained ground in several Swabian, Alsatian, and Rhenish cities, while princes like Philip of Hessen saw the Swiss as potential allies of the Schmalkaldic League. The Schmalkalders' defeat in 1547 exposed the risks of confessionally based alliances, while the Swiss were increasingly reluctant to accept the liabilities that came with additional associates. Even existing associates were neglected. For example, Rottweil allowed its associate status to lapse during the later 16th century, when, like many other imperial cities, it saw greater advantages in cooperating with more immediate neighbors in the Kreisassembly and with the other cities in the Reichstag. It tried to reactivate the link when threatened by the Duke of Württemberg during the Thirty Years' War. That conflict threatened to reopen confessional tensions within the Confederation, which struggled to maintain neutrality. The Swiss only lodged an ineffectual protest when Württemberg captured Rottweil in 1632, and instead it was the imperial army that liberated the city 2 years later. The Swiss opt-out of imperial institutions meant their voice carried no weight within the empire's legal system, preventing them from aiding their associates. Estates. The Dutch and Bohemian Revolts. The incorporated assemblies that emerged in virtually all territories from the late 14th century were another form of association. They enjoyed a stronger legal basis than peasant communes, whose rights were more local, while their involvement in territorial taxation and politics had encouraged a higher level of institutional development, with committees, archives, fiscal systems, and often involvement in militia organization. They also combined several status groups, unlike rural and urban communes, which generally excluded clergy and nobility, the two wealthiest social estates. Estates offered two possible alternatives to princely-led territorialization. They could develop trans-territorial federations, similar to the larger Alpine Leagues, but based on agreements between estates' assemblies rather than among towns and incorporated valleys. Alternatively, they might remain within territorial boundaries, but transform government along more republican lines. Both possibilities were early modern phenomena, the first peaking between about 1560 and 1620, with the emergence of the Dutch Republic and the outbreak of the Bohemian Revolt. The estates of the seven northern Burgundian provinces formed a union in 1579, following their rebellion against Spanish rule around a decade earlier. The union established its own common institutions in 1585, effectively becoming an independent republic by 1609. Though a further 27 years of renewed fighting after 1621 were necessary to secure definitive recognition from Spain. The republic's official name was the United Provinces, each of which was governed by its own states or assembly, composed of representatives from towns and landowning knights. The seven states sent delegates to a common States General to coordinate defense and represent the Republic to outsiders. The Dutch initially struggled to govern without a king, briefly raising the prospect between 1577 and 1581 that they might accept Archduke Matthias, the future emperor, as a constitutional monarch. He was followed by François d'Anjou as Prince et Seigneur until the latter's death in 1584 coincided with more favorable military circumstances that enabled radicals to consolidate a more republican form of government. A serious monarchical element was nonetheless retained in the position of stadtholder, or governor, appointed by the states of each province. These positions could be combined by one person, enabling the influential princes of Orange to assume political leadership of the republic for long periods. The Dutch were thus well on their way to establishing an estates-based republic when the Protestant nobility of the Austrian monarchy sought to use similar institutions to underpin their bid for constitutional and religious liberties after 1618. The Bohemian and Austrian estates were well established and accustomed to cooperating across provincial boundaries to coordinate taxes and defense against the Turks. They also had strong ties to their Polish and Hungarian equivalents, thanks to the legacy of common rule under the Jagiellon family. Many humanists considered Polish and Czech as dialects of a common language, while aristocrats of all four countries were frequently multilingual or could at least converse with each other in Latin. Study at German and Italian universities provided further common bonds, as did military service against the Turks. Above all, they shared concepts of corporate rights, libertates, conceiving themselves as societas civilis, sustained by individual engagement for the public good through office holding, representation in provincial diets, and general opposition to dominium absolutum, or unrestrained royal rule, considered dangerous to all inhabitants. The ideology of the estates as public guardians gained ground with the Habsburg failures and dynastic infighting after 1606, while concessions from the rival archdukes added to each province's store of privileges. The famous Letter of Majesty, extorted from Rudolf II, allowed the Protestant members of the Bohemian estates to establish what amounted to a parallel government after 1609. However, the dynasty's renewed confidence enticed many key figures to signal renewed loyalty by converting to Catholicism. Skillful management ensured that the Bohemian Diet accepted Archduke Ferdinand, the future emperor, as their king in June 1617. The Bohemian elite was thus far from united when the radical malcontents staged the defenestration of Prague in May 1618, precipitating a full-scale revolt. However, it would be wrong to see the revolt in the Austrian Habsburg lands as doomed on account of its largely aristocratic leadership, compared to their supposedly more progressive bourgeois Dutch equivalents. The Dutch provinces were already Europe's most economically advanced region. The rebels benefited from continued economic growth, enabling them to develop permanent, disciplined armed forces whose loyalty was secured through regular pay. This enabled the Dutch to win independence with the conventional military methods of a regular army under state control, despite the significance of both their civic militia and maritime piracy to republican ideology. Theirs was not a people's war. The Bohemian and Austrian rebels attempted the same, even preferring to negotiate for Ottoman military aid rather than arm their peasants. However, they never solved their financial problems, and their army's discontent at its pay arrears was a major factor in its catastrophic defeat at White Mountain in 1620. The Bohemian rebels formally deposed Ferdinand and established the Confederatio Bohemica on the 31st of July, 1619. The five Bohemian provinces established a confederation, whilst retaining self-government like the Dutch provinces. Although in many ways still conservative, the confederation's leadership adopted new institutions, like a general diet of all five provinces and a common supreme court. In an effort to make the union work, Bohemia accepted parity of status and rights with the other four provinces. The confederation was extended on the 16th of August through a federation with the Protestant rebel factions in Upper and Lower Austria, while later an alliance was formed with the Prince of Transylvania, who had instigated renewed revolt in Habsburg-Hungary. The Confederates designed their constitution ahead of offering the Bohemian crown to Frederick V, the Elector Palatine, who unwisely accepted, thereby widening the revolt into the Thirty Years' War. Whilst following a broadly similar trajectory to the Dutch, the Bohemian rebels moved faster in rejecting the Habsburgs, thanks to their stronger identity as a distinct country. Like the Dutch, they faced considerable problems in rallying the support of the wider population. There were still substantial Catholic minorities who were discriminated against under the new constitution, and whose presence increased the Habsburgs' incentive to continue fighting. The leading rebels were largely Calvinists, whereas the majority of Bohemians were Utraquists or Lutherans. The obviously Calvinist bias of Frederick V and his courtiers alienated many Bohemians. Religious diversity was both greater and more problematic than during the Dutch Revolt. Despite their common bonds, there were also significant divisions between Austria, Bohemia, and Hungary, as well as amongst their component provinces, while the tradition of general diets was less established than that of the Burgundian States General. Concern for provincial liberties frustrated military and fiscal coordination, seriously undermining the Confederation's war effort. Wider circumstances were also against the Bohemians and their allies. Their uprising was broadly regarded as a repeat of the earlier Dutch Revolt, which had been marked by sectarian violence and civil war. The defenestration immediately rebounded on the rebels. Their preferred choice as leader, the Lutheran Saxon elector Johann Georg I, refused to have anything to do with them, and eventually aided Ferdinand II in crushing the rebellion. International assistance was less forthcoming or effective than that received by the Dutch, with the Dutch themselves aiding the Bohemians only as a means to keep both Habsburg branches distracted. The Jülich-Cleves Estates Union. The historical prominence of the Dutch and Bohemian revolts has overshadowed another example of estates-based federalism, the union of the Cleves, Mark, Jülich, and Berg estates in 1521. This was formed to match the acquisition of all four principalities by a single family previously ruling just Cleves and Mark. All four assemblies retained their own administration and laws, but the previous two pairings of Cleves-Mark and Jülich-Berg forged closer ties. Further consolidation was inhibited by the spread of Protestantism, which failed to convert all inhabitants, leaving the four principalities confessionally mixed. The estates also suffered from the usual tensions between nobles and towns over the subdivision of tax burdens. However, the Duke was also unable to forge a more unitary administration, not least due to his defeat by Charles V in 1542-1543 over rival claims to Geldern, which left him with 633,000 thalers in debt. The Duke was then forced to allow the four estates a greater role in governance. The estates retained influence throughout the 16th century, thanks to further problems. The Dutch revolt after 1566 threatened to destabilize the entire Lower Rhine, while the accession of the mentally ill Duke Johann Wilhelm in 1592 opened the question of succession, as he had no direct heirs. The ducal government regularly dealt with a combined committee representing the four estates from the 1580s, especially to promote an ironic form of Christianity intended to reduce sectarianism and deny outsiders excuses for intervention. A month ahead of Johann Wilhelm's death in May 1609, the estates agreed to remain united and not to favor either of the two main claimants, Brandenburg or Pfalz-Neuburg. They failed to prevent a short war in 1609-1610 that led to de facto partition, with Brandenburg holding Cleves and Mark, and Pfalz-Neuburg occupying Jülich and Berg. Nonetheless, estates envoys continued to work for an amicable settlement, and they were included collectively in the Treaty of Xanten, 1614, by which Spain and the Dutch avoided open war by mutually accepting continued partition of this strategic area. The estates renewed their union in 1647, as it was feared the partition might become permanent. They hoped to preserve the integrity of the four principalities and their associated dependencies in Ravenstein and Ravensberg. These goals were traditional, and the estates did not seek to usurp princely powers and form a republic. However, the princes suspected them of wanting to turn Dutch through a federation with the United Provinces. Dutch commercial and religious influence was strong across the Lower Rhine and Westphalia, and was underpinned between 1614 and 1679 by the occupation of strategic small towns. Charges of seeking to join the Dutch were also leveled against the estates of both East Frisia and the bishopric of Münster. The princes' criticism reflected genuine fears for their own authority, but was also good propaganda, since it presented the estates as trying to leave the empire. The estates were also disadvantaged by the Peace of Westphalia, which firmly identified them as belonging to the mediate political sphere, thus clearly denying them the right to negotiate with external powers. Elector Frederick William of Brandenburg was particularly aggressive, refusing to allow a general diet of the United Estates and attempting to isolate them by dealing with each individually. However, the elector overplayed his hand by invading Jülich-Berg in a bid to seize the entire inheritance in 1651. Although they lacked formal representation in the Reichstag, the estates sent envoys to the meeting in 1653-1654, causing Frederick William to fear that Emperor Ferdinand III might respond to their petition by depriving him of Cleves and Mark. However, the outcome indicated that the days of estates unions were over. Ferdinand III preferred to deal with the elector, who, as an imperial prince, was party to much wider political issues, notably resolving Sweden's relationship to the empire following the Thirty Years' War. Brandenburg's compromise with Pfalz-Neuburg in 1666 removed the estate's last hope, as both princes agreed that the partition was permanent and forbade further unions between the assemblies. Republicanism. Republican ideas were rarely involved in these struggles, except for the Dutch, once they decided to reject Spanish rule entirely. Dutch republicanism was inspired by the late humanist reading of ancient Greek and Roman history and philosophy that presented an idealized society of sober, patriotic citizens. This aspect of the classical legacy was largely rejected in the empire, which drew inspiration instead from Imperial Rome. Later 16th century observers interpreted the French and Netherlands civil wars as the direct consequence of monarchomax, or self-appointed kingmakers, who had usurped divine authority and overturned all proper order. These beliefs were reinforced by the experience of the Bohemian Revolt and subsequent Thirty Years' War, as well as the parallel British Civil Wars, which culminated in the execution of Charles I in January 1649 and Cromwell's military dictatorship. By the late 17th century, German thinkers even criticized their few predecessors, like Johannes Althusius, who had advocated a greater role for territorial estates in governance. Most commentators interpreted republicanism as moral rather than constitutional, relating it to the early modern ideal of a res publica, or a commonwealth where liberties were safeguarded by orderly government and the rule of law. This accorded estates their traditional role as part of the broader multi-layered legal structure protecting German liberties in the empire. Gottlieb Samuel Treuer was the first to link despotism explicitly with tyranny in 1719, thereby encouraging a trend to discuss politics in binary abstract terms like freedom or slavery, rather than as remedies for specific problems. However, the empire's political pluralism encouraged most writers to focus on finding the right balance among existing institutions, rather than present politics as a stark choice between diverging alternatives. The century after the Thirty Years' War saw the slow acceptance of the idea of the impersonal state at the level of the empire's territories, defining these as public entities embodied less by their princes than by charters, laws, and legal agreements belonging to all inhabitants. This adversely affected how many intellectuals viewed the estates, which were increasingly criticized as sectional, corporate interest groups, rather than benevolent guardians of inhabitants' liberties. Authors now assigned civil freedoms to a new conception of the private sphere, in which individuals were entitled to act as they pleased within the law, sheltered from arbitrary state intervention. Debates increasingly hinged on what form of government could best guarantee such freedoms. The outbreak of the American Revolutionary War in 1775 attracted wide attention, not least because America's last king, George III, was also Elector of Hanover and hired 30,000 Germans to suppress the kind of liberties many intellectuals desired for the empire. The war placed a German monarch clearly in a despotic, even tyrannical role. The debate widened during the 1780s as intellectuals deliberately addressed wider audiences through the burgeoning periodicals and regular press, leading to calls for people's representation by 1790. These advocated replacing assemblies based on corporate social status with gender and wealth criteria, simultaneously opening direct representation to all richer males, while still denying it to the poor and more clearly excluding all females. Although some writers now envisaged states without princes, debates in the empire still differed from those in the Anglophone world. English-speaking writers since the late 17th century had linked political organization to property. The primary purpose of the social contract, believed to underpin civil society, was the preservation of property. Consequently, property owners should have a say in government, an argument that the Americans expressed in 1775 as no taxation without representation. By contrast, German writers generally continue to define the state as the rule of law, arguing that good laws protected rights and property. Justi still saw the estates, like Althusius had, as guardians of laws rather than lawmakers. Most Germans regarded fully republican government as dangerous, citing the examples of Britain and Poland-Lithuania to argue that disassociating representation from corporate groups and incorporated communities gave too much scope for divisive parties and factions. Without imperative mandates, representatives would be free to pursue their own self-interests. These arguments gained a new lease of life as news arrived after 1789 of the horrifying excesses of the French revolutionaries. While the final two Polish partitions, 1793 and 1795, suggested that factionalism could lead to political extinction, actual practice remained in the established pattern, as exemplified by the discussions since 1762 of how to revive Saxony, which had been devastated during the Seven Years' War. The need to finance reform raised the question of taxation and representation, but proposals concentrated on detailed tinkering with existing structures. For example, by suggesting the nobles should assume a greater share of common burdens and allow commoners holding knights' fiefs to exercise the associated rights to participate in diets. The pace of change accelerated slightly following large-scale peasant protest between August and October 1790. The Saxon estates were modified in 1805, but it was not until 1831 that they were replaced by a two-chamber parliament that finally abolished the nobles' patrimonial jurisdiction in 1855. The Saxon unrest encompassed 50 parishes and was the largest popular protest in the empire outside the Habsburg lands since the Peasants' War. It was caused by frustration at the local court's inability to clear a backlog of 230 cases against lordly exactions and abuses. Contemporaries stressed the differences between Saxony and France, including the resolution of the former's problems through the established methods of administrative and judicial review, rather than mass bloodshed. The Saxons were not seeking a new form of government, but to make the existing one work properly. Where peasants did criticize estates as unrepresentative, it was simply to reinforce demands that they be included as a corporate group. Association was thus a way in which different social groups could secure specific identities and rights within a hierarchical corporate legal and political order. The next chapter examines how this order attempted to regulate disputes between these groups, and how far it could accommodate further change by the late 18th century.